south for ended up on California.
Which is on Oh.
Yes.
It's here. It's here at ADOC.
What's that?
It's here on ADOC.
Oh, they're bringing them, yeah. He's a great
Who
guy.
is that?
That's me and him in 2008. You see. Oh, wow. I look better than them, too. You knew him, huh?
Oh, yeah, he's a really good guy. Where's Fishrath?
Westport, I think. But he was kind of the president of the Washington College Association.
See, I moved to closed session. So I'm going to call to order the regular session of the regular meeting of the Board of Commissioners of the Humboldt Bay Harbor Recreation and Conservation District. The time is 6:04. May we have a roll call, please?
Commissioner Newman,
here.
Mr. Dale,
here.
Commissioner Benson,
Here.
Commissioner Norton,
Here.
and President Coleman.
Present. Will you join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, thank you.
Do we have a report on closed session?
Yeah, no reportable action was taken during closed session.
All right, thank you. Gonna move to public comment, but before I do, I guess we have people online, right? And so,
Yeah, in the platform.
okay. And so people online can participate by raising their hands or star nine if you are on a telephone, and we will recognize you and you can join in the regular times to make comments, including in public comment, which is coming up right now. This portion of the agenda allows the public to speak to the board on various issues not itemized on this agenda. Member of the public may also request that a matter appearing on the consent calendar, which comes up next, be pulled and discussed separately. Pursuant to the Brown Act, the board may not take any action on any item that does not appear on the agenda. Each speaker is limited to speak for a period of 3 minutes regarding each item on the agenda, and each speaker is limited to speak for a period of 3 minutes during the public comment portion of the agenda regarding items of special interest to the public not appearing on the agenda and that are within the subject matter of the jurisdiction of the Board of Commissioners. Would anyone like to provide public comment tonight? Seeing none in person and none online. All right, then we will move to the consent calendar. Looks like.
I move to approve consent.
Second.
Motion and a second. Who second was that? Andy was asking. All right, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed or abstaining? Okay. We have consensus on the consent calendar. Communications, reports, and correspondence received. Do you have any correspondence?
No correspondence received.
Then would you like to give an executive director report?
Yeah, no photos this month, but participated in Leadership Redwood Coast. It's a program of the Chamber Foundation, something that Rob and I have done in the past as well, and did a tour, talked with the group a little bit about, of course, the Heavy Lift Marine Terminal, Nordic Aqua Farms, and then a little bit more in depth on the other things that we do and what some of the key initiatives are for the Harbor District outside of our development projects. It's always fascinating to see people that don't understand what we do in the aquaculture world. So had a great trip there with Eric Carr and Scott Thompson of Nordic. As part of the Heavy Lift Marine Terminal project and this Baywide Master Plan, one of the opportunities was to go port wide to the private terminals. And I did that with Adam. And really, what my purpose in being there was is I wanted to get on a couple of sites that I hadn't been on, but also to discuss current and future uses. And you know, I'm happy to share that there is vision in this port for these private terminals, even you know that aren't district-owned terminals, and people do have desire to work with the district. In fact, there was open invitation there to do more, and that's exactly what I was hoping that would be accomplished. So, fun to spend some time with Adam, and we talked, of course, about wind uses, but about other opportunities as well. Went on a site tour of the heavy lift terminal site with the community advisory committee, some of the people from that. Again, great to get people out on the site and have, you know, seen as believing, and they're seeing the opportunity there for brownfield cleanup, getting a better view of upfront, you know, water's edge, if you will. And it's just good conversation. It's really enjoyable to engage with people, and the questions always amaze me. Good job on that, Rob. The RWE and Vineyard leadership teams have been meeting with Rob and I. They've been coming in pretty regularly. We now have a monthly visit with RWE and Vineyard is periodically throughout the month. And both are very focused on the opportunity out here in California. So I want to continue to report on that. The Harbor Safety Committee met last month. It's good news. I've commented on this past. We've had a real issue with navigation. We reached out to the sector commander, Jordan Baldwin, and said, look, you know, we need help. Immediately thereafter, we had the cutter Adler or Alder here, rather, and that's a buoy tender, and got a buoy work getting done, and then came back for follow-up work. So I want to give a real special thank you to the U.S. Coast Guard, specifically the sector command, San Francisco, that is. And, you know, thank them for doing that. This is a constant issue that's been coming up for 18 months to 2 years. Yeah. So nice to have that resolved and for the resolution coming. There's a bit more work that has to be done, but it's very much underway. We also met as a Bar Pilots Advisory Committee and getting prepared to do some more work around the port, hopefully to be able to do surveys here directly, and a meeting in September with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers specific to some of our navigation and general operations that involve the Corps of Engineers here in the Port of Humboldt Bay. Getting ready to start a King Salmon community project. There is a Fields Landing King Salmon sea level rise slash flooding slash we live in a real low-lying area, we're against the water, a committee that's meeting. Craig was approached by a student, our Commissioner Benson, rather, I'm sorry, out of Cal Poly Humboldt that was interested in perhaps doing some stuff in our recreation area there. And while funds and opportunities there are limited, it appears that we might be able to do some community signage and enhance or remove the bus stop that's down there and do something that's a little bit more suited for the neighborhood. So very excited to be working with her. It's in Commissioner Newman's district, so I've been keeping him abreast, and I'll be, you know, getting together with Craig and Aaron as soon as she submits her drawings. But it looks like we might have a fun little project there. And she's a student of Lori Richmond's. Lori continues to refer folks to us as well. So happy to be doing that. Attending the local CSDA, local chapter meetings. We don't have as much involvement in this as the water districts do. This is really the community service districts that are doing this, but learning a lot, learning about opportunities that are out there that we weren't taking advantage of. And there's a lot of opportunity with this for the California Special Districts Association. So really getting a lot more involved there. Then we had our City of Eureka Harbor District 2x2. The city's working on some updates that could benefit us in the long term for development here on the island. So we're happy to engage on that. And of course, we talked about our general business that we share together, such as dredging of our marinas, state tideland responsibilities, trust lands, and our desire to continue to work cooperatively and get marine debris and vessels out of the bay. So, you know, all good meetings, no photographs this month. Going to end with the city of Arcata. We had a meeting with them yesterday. They were talking about their long range wastewater planning. Obviously, we want our outfall line used. We're very interested to see that used. And that's not necessarily on the table. It was a topic of discussion. But we also have a lot of advocacy to do for aquaculture and water quality. So it's nice to meet with them, and happy to see Emily Sinkhorn. Hadn't seen her, even though it was online, you know, 5 miles away in quite some time. I'll pass it over to Rob.
I have no report this month.
All right, then. Do we have a district council report?
Nothing for me.
All right. And doesn't look like we have an engineer treasurer.
We do have an engineer report.
Oh, online?
I'm the engineer.
Oh, okay.
So in terms of Nordic Aquafarms, FHN conducted additional field surveys of eel grass and uplands for the Bay Street Mitigation Project. They've been doing all the botany surveys in preparation for development of that site. Phil's Landing Boatyard, this has been a challenging project for us to get going. And so I don't know, this thing is not working. There we go. So one of the things is we're really focused on our inspections down there, making sure that we have compliance down at the boatyard in terms of our industrial general permit. On the treatment system, that cost continues to grow, and we have some groundwater issues there potentially. So now we're looking at adjusting the design to have some of that on upland. It means larger pumps, but lower level of maintenance if it's up above, and it reduces costs so we can achieve that. So quite a bit of design and coordination occurring there. We need to do a couple more quick field studies, but we think we found a pathway to get underway with that probably you know, late fall. And it's all work that can be done year round. There isn't enough disturbance to the ground there to not. They reviewed the analytical results from the wash water treatment system. So we renewed our permit, as you're aware, for our wash water treatment system. We have to test that before dosing, and we continue to get really good results. So we know when we go through our carbon filter system, we're achieving what we need to have. The RM2 outfall line, we're working through the various permitting requirements and activities for the pipeline repair project. There's some updated design, anchoring design that's due here in the next month. And then meeting with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers again on the reuse of the dredge materials. I'm probably looking at 27 now, not 26. But that coordination still continues to go well. Real special thanks to Savannah Fanning and Ellie Covington from the Corps. And then they're putting some additional cost estimates together for some permitting environmental review related to this outfall line, because we're looking at maybe a little bit bigger footprint. And so more detail to come on that, but Mike wanted to make sure that his work was noted. RM2, the former LP solid waste dump, we have our solid waste site. We have a 5-year sampling that has to occur. That'll be done this month. And we have Erlen from their group present when we do that sampling. It's a very large sampling suite of the monitoring wells at the solid waste disposal site. For those of you that are unaware, it's the big mounds that you see out by the pulp mill. Shelter Cove, as you know, FEMA is proceeding out there. We're only 1/3 of the approval way through, but we're looking at, you know, at least stabilization and what next steps would look like for the boat launch and access areas. And then finally, the RMT1 brownfield. The initial phase one inspections will be done in the month of September, so we'll be perhaps reporting on that at the next board meeting. But they're working with us and Mindy on all of the reporting requirements of the grant, as well as getting our submissions to Acres. That's how we get paid. So that's Mike's report.
Great, thank you. Is it too early to have gotten any sort of results from the near placement that occurred with the last? The
USGS just loaded up their equipment and drove away.
Oh,
so okay. Yeah, the plan was for them to come back July or August. They literally were here loading the truck yesterday and the day before.
So we should get a report.
So I think we'll hear quite a bit. Yeah.
Great. Look forward to that. Commissioner reports. Who would like to go first?
I'll start.
Plan report.
Yeah. Oh, was there a district plan?
No, not tonight.
Thank you for checking.
Yeah, I've been participating in the Green Harbor Advisory Committee and made some comments on the policy document. That's about it.
Okay, thank you, Jack. Craig?
I continue to be part of the steering committee. We just met yesterday morning, and it's looking at the next CAC meeting, possibly being at the Phyllis Rex townhomes. That continues to be really important. On the side of that, I'm still attending monthly Sea Level Rise Institute meetings and now reviewing the fifth climate change assessment for the North Coast document that the governor has appointed a number of us to. So we're finally, you know, getting through that, getting into a draft form of something to send back to Sacramento about what we think they ought to invest in here in terms of climate resilience.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for digging into those weighty documents.
Yeah. Greg?
So I did participate in a marine terminal committee meeting. Not a whole lot new going on there, just more steady in the boat. I will say that it's been a pleasure to have served on REDEC for the last, I don't know, 12 years. But a person, my friend, and I think a stellar human being, David Lindberg from the 3rd District of the Humble Bay Municipal Water District, passed away last month in a tragic motorcycle accident. Mm-hmm. David was a stand-up human being and a stand-up public servant. And I enjoyed every single moment I got to spend with him. So I just thought we should at least give him some acknowledgement and say Godspeed, David. Other than that, I don't have, what else have we done? Oh, we had a pilots meeting. That was pretty productive, I think. Chris, well done in managing that meeting and leading that meeting. I think you did a great job. I apologize for not being there in person, but probably got more done because I wasn't there.
We made you talk.
Yeah. I think things are looking up in the pilot side. And I'm excited. We just need more work for them. And we're getting there.
Hell, those guys are a full-time job. And make no mistake about it.
Yeah, they are a full-time job. Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, that's all I got.
I also participated in the pilot committee meeting and the 2x2. I thought they were both very productive, especially some of the zoning discussions with City of Eureka. I also was on a boat tour on the Matticat for some of the members of the Peninsula community. Got to hear their concerns about the possibilities surrounding the heavy lift terminal project. It's very interesting to understand how folks are feeling about it out there. I actually got to go catch some salmon commercially in Oregon and some albacore. First time I got to catch a salmon commercially in almost 3 years, and it felt really good. And they were big fish too. They were 14-pound average dress fish. So 5 days, we got 120 fish. So it's pretty good fishing. Some really bad news for the fishing fleet. I don't know if everybody's aware, but a lot of people choose to fish alone on their boats. And the Carolise has been brought into Humboldt Bay. A dear friend and political advocate for the fishing industry for many, many years, Joel Kawahara, was fishing alone and fell over a couple days ago, and they found his boat. So it's one of those really bad things, and he was a really great guy. So that's my report.
For that, sorry. Sad to hear news on both those public servants. Let's see, I brought some pictures. I don't know if I guess before I get to that, I also participated in the community advisory committee meeting and some planning meetings for an upcoming event, which I guess there'll probably be more announcements or speaking about later. So
is that the high?
What's that? That is the Ritz, actually. Huh? So I also had the opportunity to participate in the beginning of the Elected Officials to Protect America's public leadership training certificate program with a trip to DC, and did not know at the time that there was going to be such a strong Humboldt contingent. So I'm there with Stacey Atkins from Arcata, Katerina from Humboldt Area Foundation, and Kat from the Blue Lake City Council. We were all invited there. And it's a really interesting organization that some of you have probably heard of. They've been out here to Humboldt a couple times recently, but were founded by veterans who had really identified climate change as a global security issue and a driver of a lot of global conflict, and we're working with veterans who were interested in local public service that expanded to those of us like myself who are not veterans, but we're still interested in doing what we could in whatever way to help these issues, and had a very productive, interesting weekend. There were people there from Great Britain, including a Lord. It was the first time I think I've met a Lord. And Singapore, and a strong contingent from Ukraine, which was really great to see them, and just really brought to, so I mean, we all know what's going on in Ukraine, or at least some of what's going on. I've heard more stories of stuff that I hadn't known what was going on, but just putting faces to it, and these people are still very vibrant and trying to do a lot of good work in energy and in other fields. But when we think about the issues we have with development of our harbor here, at least we're not having anybody shooting missiles at any of our sites right now, so we have that going for us, I guess. So this is going to continue for another 6 weeks, I believe, virtually. We formed a subgroup that's supposed to work together on developing some policy recommendations or some other type of recommendations. And I think we got as far as like coming up with a name that is Just Clean. So looking at justice and clean standing for community-led action network to help facilitate clean energy projects and combat disinformation on the local level, which I think is something that's really needed. So that's my report. We'll move on to the agenda. And the first item is, not surprisingly, receive status update regarding the Humble Bay Offshore Wind Heavy Lift Marine Terminal Project, including an update of the Green Terminal Roadmap.
All right. So we have two speakers from the East Coast. So I'm anxious to get to them to set them free. But first, I have some information I don't love to share. So we're going to announce an update to the timeline. So this is the timeline that we have been discussing for quite a while. Where special studies were coming to an end relatively soon, and then CEQA, NEPA permits, or at least the draft environmental impact report, would be ready in March of 26, with design continuing through 27, and then construction happening in sequence in the subsequent years. For reasons I'll explain in a moment, we need to push out the schedule so that it looks like CEQA draft environmental impact report won't come to you until the end of the calendar year of 26, with some possible window into 27, which then pushes out the design timeline and pushes back construction, though those dates were always speculative. It depends a lot on what the energy companies need. So the revised timeline generally comes down to CEQA draft environmental impact report coming to you in late 26. I'm pushing really hard before the end of that calendar year, you know, September, October. And these are some of the reasons why the project timeline is delayed. So we received a grant from the CEC. Those funds were supposed to come to us in April. And each month they've been pushed back and we still don't have those funds and may not until October. So that has delayed a lot of special studies, which cascades through. The phase one site assessment is slower than expected, which is holding back a lot of the CEQA analysis. And then we have a lot of cumulative grants that we're balancing, which has delayed some special studies. And the energy companies seem to be slowing down. So those are some of the reasons. Happy to talk about those after our speakers. So we have speakers tonight, Tom and Josh, about foundation assembly and equipment, cranes, and vessels. Whichever, I think I have Tom listed first in the presentation. And he may be presenting both.
There we go. Yeah, I am presenting both. That's correct. One second here. Let me just get my screen share going. Can you guys see my screen?
No.
No? Is that... How about now?
No.
There, no. There it goes.
There we go. Okay.
Get now.
All right. So I was asked to speak on both foundation assembly and the types of cranes and vessels and equipment that we'll see at the yard once it's fully developed. I spoke last month, but my name is Thomas Hickey. I'm a port planner at Moffitt & Nickel. I work out of our Boston office, and I kind of jump around between any type of offshore wind projects that we have. I also have a background in naval architecture, marine engineering, and working for offshore wind developers. So the basics of floating foundation assembly, essentially I'm reusing this slide again from last month, but it's very similar to marshalling of wind turbine generator components, where we have large components being manufactured someplace else, brought into the assembly yard, pieced together, and then put out the final product for integration with a WTG. So what is a floating foundation? Floating foundations serve as the base for wind turbine generator systems in deep water, where fixed solutions are no longer technically or financially viable. Currently, most of the foundations that you see in fixed projects in the US are monopiles. They're just a large steel pipe driven into the ground with a tower attached to the top of them. Those foundations tend to max out around 40 or 50 meters of depth. There are also jacket foundations that max out around 60 meters of depth. And for they can go bigger for substations and things like that. But after that point, it just becomes overly expensive or technically difficult to achieve. And you move on to a floating foundation. So generally, when we're looking at a floating foundation, there's something called water plane area, which is the area of the foundation that intersects with the surface of the water. Generally, they want to limit that water plane area because more water plane area means more interaction with surface waves and more motion. So there's dozens and dozens of different design proposals falling into several categories. Several categories, types of foundations. On the left side here, you see Principal Power's semi-submersible foundation, the Windfloat F. These are typically partially submerged, and they're essentially connected buoyancy modules. You can see those three vertical beams connected by horizontal beams to provide stability, minimize motion, and hold the turbine up. The next type would be tension leg platforms, shown in the middle here. This is Glosson's LSR TLP. Which is a design based out of Washington State. These foundations are mostly submerged, and they gain most of their stability by taut mooring lines. You can see in that image there are those vertical mooring lines rather than slack or semi-taut systems. There are also spar-type foundations, which are essentially monopiles. I didn't show an image of those here because they're extremely unlikely to be used in the U.S. They require substantial water depth that really doesn't exist any place other than areas with very deep fjords. There are also hybrid designs shown here on the right as the Steedsdale Tetris Bar. This one actually uses a counterweight that hangs below this foundation to make it act like a TLP, but is anchored with a more conventional system. So it's kind of a combination of the semi-submersibles and the TLPs. The ones that you'll probably see in Humboldt Bay or in California in general are semi-subs and TLPs, mostly because of the water depth that we have here. So what is a foundation assembly facility, and why do we need one? Similar to a staging and integration site, components are imported, assembled, and exported. It's essentially a essentially, it's a marshaling yard for foundations. Components come in from the manufacturer otherwhere. They're assembled to finish, unit launched in the water. Completed foundations are either too big to be shipped all at once, or it's uneconomical. For example, components for numerous foundations can fit onto one delivery vessel, or the same vessel maybe only can carry one or two fully assembled foundations. So it's more about efficiency. So the import of components, I'm reusing this slide also from last month, just because this is so new that we don't actually have any great images of these things being assembled. This is yet to be done on a commercial scale. So there's likely going to be a larger delivery vessel for these components. And you'll see that most of the components will probably be rolled on or rolled off, like you see in the right image. But there may also be lift on, lift off operations, either with vessels with their own crane or shoreside. So once the components are in the yard, they're stored in the uplands and then brought together for foundation assembly. And I'll start this with an asterisk saying that where this is something that is so new and hasn't really yet been done on a commercial scale, foundation designers and offshore wind developers in general are still trying to figure out exactly what this process looks like. There's two main schools of thought right now. On the left, you see production line assembly. This is Principal Power and HSD Sungyong's concept for a yard where essentially these foundations are being put together in stages in a typical assembly line fashion and slid down the line either on rails or on SPMTs. The second type would be spot production, where each foundation has its own spot, is assembled from start to finish in that spot, and then moved to the wharf for launching. So launching of the foundations, again, similar to the numerous designs there are for foundations, there are also a lot of schools of thought about how these will be these foundations will be launched into the water. There are numerous proposed methods, some novel, some traditional, like, for example, traditional methods, graving docks or just a crane, and more novel methods like jacking, platform lifts, things like that. One of the most common and flexible solutions being proposed right now would be the use of a semi-submersible barge. These would be very similar to a floating dry dock that you might see at a shipyard in California or Washington or Oregon. Essentially, the foundation rolls off the pier onto this semi-submersible barge. The barge is brought to an area of deeper water, and then the barge sinks down, allowing the foundation to float off. The reason that we're focusing more on these jacking and lift systems are technically more complex, and they use up a lot of the upland space. So we think right now for a jacking or a platform system lift, you're probably looking at like 4.5 to 5 acres of uplands, which is obviously very impactful both to our operations and to the construction of the port. Yeah, so once the foundation is floated off of the semi-submersible barge, it will be towed back to the staging integration site, put to berth, and then the tower and nacelle and blades will be assembled atop. On the left side here, you see a semi-submersible barge launching in Zhoushan. I hope I said that correctly, in China. And on the right side, you see Boa Barge 36 launching SBM Offshore's foundation. I believe this is in Rotterdam. So moving on to equipment and vessels. We touched on some of these things last month, but to reiterate, so lifting equipment, the bread and butter of the lifting equipment in these types of terminals are what are called SPMTs or self-propelled modular transporters. They tend to be about 8 feet by 36 feet, depending on the size of them. They can come in 4, 5, or 6 axle, I believe even all the way up to 8 axle now, modules. These modules can, they each have four, like I said, 4 or 6 axles. Each set of wheels can move independently. The deck is raised and lowered hydraulically, essentially like a large flatbed. They're moving towards electric variants for a variety of reasons. It's much more flexible for them. They don't have to refuel, and that's what we're designing for at the heavy lift terminal. They can be linked together in numerous configurations, and then they're charged when they're not in use, similar to like an electric vehicle. We also are going to have crawler cranes, which will be used both in foundation assembly and staging integration operations, primarily for in the latter for vessel offloading and movement in the yard. These can be up to 450 feet in height, and they'll be used to move around, like I said, up, unload from the delivery vessels and assemble components in the uplands. We also will have a ring crane, most likely, in the staging integration site. These are the only cranes capable at the moment of assembling these new 20 to 25 megawatt WTGs. They can be up to 775 feet in height for this activity. And it's really impressive. They can actually lift almost 2,000 tons to that height. So really, really impressive piece of technology. You see right here, this is Heisman BMS crane. We're also you'll also see a lot of when you look at upring cranes for offshore wind, you'll see the SK6000 from Amut, which is also been designed for offshore wind activities. Delivery vessels. So we'll have two main types of delivery vessels. These are the vessels that bring components into the facility, both WTG and foundation components. They could be something like the Rotremer, which is shown here on the left. This vessel was specifically designed for one of the WTG O&Ms, and I think it's GE, but I might be blanking on that right now. These types of vessels may or may not have their own onboard cranes. Those with cranes are called geared vessels and may be capable of unloading without the use of shoreside cranes. Those without are ungeared and require a shoreside crane, most likely a crawler crane for unloading. Or ro-ros. The Rotremer is actually a hybrid ship and can do both ro-ro and crane activities. The second type, which we're seeing more commonly used as component sizes grow and developers wish to maximize the components being transported in one trip, are open deck heavy lift cranes like the MV Blue Marlin shown to the right. These vessels will either require shoreside cranes or ro-ro operations for unloading. Some of them may have semi-submersible capabilities, allowing them to perform foundation launches. This is unlikely in Humboldt with the current depth restrictions. They may need up to 90 feet of water to submerge, substantially more than the semi-submersible barges, which take about, which need about 50 to 60 feet to float off the foundation. And like I said, the reason that these open deck carriers are becoming more and more common, especially on the West Coast, we think that these will be used more because the manufacturing bases are further away, so minimizing the number of trips required for the vessel. The launching barge will also be a key component of the terminal. This is, like we talked about earlier, used to launch the floating foundations. These were primarily a novel design. They have to be what's called Jones Act compliant, which means that vessels moving goods between U.S. ports needs to be U.S. built and crewed. Currently, there are no semi-submersible barges in the U.S. that are capable of doing this. So this would have to be custom built. An example shown here on the left is Boa Barge 39/40. This barge is being built right now somewhere in Europe, but won't be able to be used in some place like Humboldt Bay because it's not U.S. built. But similar dimensions are expected, maybe a bit wider, something like 550 feet long, 240 to 350 feet wide. It may even be modular, and the draft would be variable based on the design. On the right, you see a team of these barges launching the world's first winter, sorry, the U.S.'s first home-built wind turbine installation vessel in what was also the world's largest lift by SPMTs. So this vessel actually rolled off and jacked up, so the barges didn't have to submerge and it didn't count for the Jones Act. Finally, we have tugboats. And there's a few different types that we'll see. The two major types will be anchor handling tug supply vessels, or AHTS. There's also harbor slash escort tugs. You also might see something in the similar size range as the harbor tugs that are a little bit more ocean going. So these AHTSs, these are the largest towing vessels in the world. They can have up to 200 to 300 plus tons of bollard pull, which is essentially the force put out by them. If they're at a dead stop tied to a pier, how much force can they pull on their tow line? AHTSs will be used for anchor system installation and final tow out of the integrated foundations. Like I said, they can get as big as 200 to 300 tons bollard, which is what is required for offshore wind activities. which represents less than 10% of the global fleet of anchor handling vessels. And the US, the US portion of that is even smaller. It's less than 1%. The harbor and escort tugs are a little bit less powerful, more like 75 to 125 tons bollard. But they're substantially more maneuverable. They might have Z drives or voice Schneider propulsion systems that allow them to change their thrust direction essentially instantly and easily be used both to aid the AHTS in the tow out of foundations and also help vessels and barges maneuver and dock in port. Shown on the right is an example of a harbor, a little bit more of an ocean going harbor escort tug. This is Boston Towing's MV Independence at 120 feet long. And that is it for me today. If anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Yeah, thank you, Thomas. This is Commissioner Benson. Just looking at these two types of tugs and seeing the tons that they're able to pull, how heavy are the fully integrated turbines?
Yeah, that's a great question. And another thing that really varies substantially by the design, the two primary types of foundations that we'll see are being proposed are concrete and steel. The steel foundations are substantially lighter in port, but they end up getting about the same once they're finally out to sea. And they'll ballast them at different points, either in the harbor or on the way out as they get to their final draft. The final assembled weight of a concrete semi-submersible foundation is in the range of 20 to 25,000 tons. And the fully assembled steel foundation, something between 3,500 and 7,000 tons.
Thank you.
Of course.
Any other questions from the audience, either in person or online?
Yeah, Thomas, also between all these cranes and different kinds of tugs, how many of these are available in some kind of an electric version at this point? Any of them?
Yeah, another great question. So the harbor and escort tugs, those are just starting to go electric. There's a few of them in the United States in ongoing projects. That will continue. So the availability of them is low right now, but new builds are starting to go in that direction. Anchor handling tug supply vessels are a bit different with the amount of power that they require. And there are hybrid designs out there right now, like diesel electric, that'll use electric when they don't need the power, and they'll jack on the generators when they do need it. But those are not that readily available. In terms of the cranes, they're almost entirely electric at this point. So the ones that we're designing for, the crawlers, and the crawlers are battery powered and charged overnight or when they're not being used. The ring crane is plugged directly into an outlet in the terminal, and is fully electrically powered as well.
Thank you. That's encouraging.
Of course.
I do have a question about, the noise created by the equipment, since it's mostly electric, as far as the, cranes and whatnot, are they fairly low noise pollution to the local community?
Yeah, they're fairly low noise. I actually know that we just got some data from Amut on the ring crane. I don't have it in front of me. I know that if Ashley was here, she'd be able to provide it. So I think that if you ask that question again next month, she would have an answer for you. But I don't have that in front of me now. But I do know that compared to something like a diesel generator, it's pretty quiet.
Thomas, this is Jack. Got a question regarding, you know, we're talking about not necessarily things available. I don't think we should be talking about things necessarily available today, but what things are being planned for in 3 to 5 years, maybe even outward if things go, are more delays in project development, and it could be beyond that. But so even at 4 years down, or 3 years, maybe we'll have our best case scenario, and we had construction and everything ready to go and operations in 3 years. What sort of tugboats and cranes that are being used or being studied and being built are out there?
Yeah, so the cranes are all out there. They're out there now. The SK-6000 that I mentioned was actually tested for the first time about 6 months ago. In Europe. So those products are all available now. The vessels are a little bit more difficult. There are vessels in the U.S. fleet that meet these requirements, but they're a little bit harder to come by. So I don't have a great answer for that.
Okay. Yeah, I came across this something about there was up in Vancouver, there was some cranes that were being used at one of Vancouver Harbor. I think it was a hybrid, might have been diesel and electric, or hydrogen and diesel to give it some backup. But it seems like there's a lot of research and things that are being built or being tested in different harbors throughout the West Coast, or actually the world, but United States, even on the West Coast. Do you have any information about that?
Not so much on the alternative power methods, no. I can say, though, that there are systems in place like Mahmood had talked about, where, you know, if the draw was too big for the grid, or the demand that the power that's available at the terminal, they also have the ability to trickle charge a battery bank or something like that to avoid the use of diesel emissions. And it's also just about, it's both environmental and efficiency as well, and just using the power as efficiently as possible.
Great, thanks.
And did you have a question, Rob? And
then I have one. Just something to add to that. So there was a brief update about the green terminal plan in the staff report. We'll have a more detailed report presented next month. But a couple of things to think about. Tom mentioned the Jones Act. So there could be a fleet of electric boats, tugs, ships throughout Europe and Asia. Mm-hmm. We can't use them if they're not manufactured in the U.S. And current administration isn't incentivizing that sort of development here. We also, through our grants, very well may be subject to the Build America, Buy America provisions, BABA, which means even the cranes and forklifts would have to be manufactured in the U.S. So even if there are ports in Australia that have nothing but electric forklifts, if they're not built in America, we may not be able to access them.
Well, I also came across one of the California Energy Commission and did about $1 billion to the various ports in California to go green and as much as possible. So even learning off of their experience that they're going through now, what sort of development they're coming across, or what success and what failures they're coming across. But I think there's lots of stuff to even learn right here in the United States.
Agree.
Yeah, and that's actually what I wanted to ask. With the restrictions of the Jones Act, what does the current pipeline on manufacture of these types of vessels look like in the United States now? Like, is anybody building them? When will they need to start building them if we're going to be able to actually operate a terminal?
I think that question's for you, Tom.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can tell you that the U.S. shipbuilding, from my experience as a naval architect, the U.S. shipbuilding industry is more than capable of constructing these vessels. As for a timeline, I don't have a good answer on that. But I can say that the yards have experience building vessels like this, that just not as often.
Yeah. What would the turnaround time be for building one of these anchor handling tugs? How long would it take a shipyard if we placed an order? And I know you can't answer that directly, but approximately how long does it take to build one of these ships?
If the vessel's already designed, you could see one between a year, maybe between a year to 2.5 years. It really depends on the size of the yard. But there are yards in Texas and in Florida that spit these things out all the time.
Okay. But I have to start ordering them soon.
Yeah.
Any other questions or comments? All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for staying up.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me. Have a good night, everyone.
Sympathize. I think I'm still on East Coast time myself.
Thanks, Tom.
Yep. Happy New Year.
All right. Did you add more to this topic you wanted to add, Rob?
Or? Just one slide showing what the upcoming technical speakers are. I think I added that. So September, green terminal, electrical, solar, utilities, and traffic, vehicular traffic. It's a lot of content. So let me know if you'd like to prioritize that and cut some of that content. Then October, community and tribal engagements, related waterfront facility improvement program grant activities. Hopefully we have the money by then so we can be kickstarting some of those tasks. The aquaculture committee, we were hoping to have them as guest speakers to talk about some of the work that's been done with them. And then CEQA, NEPA, and permits.
All right.
That's robust. You know, because of the delays in CEQA up till possibly, you know, October or so, 2026, is it still reasonable to have December be the impacts and mitigation theme, or might we be moving that?
We'll see. Year? Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That was an informative presentation. Moving on to new business.
Coleman.
Oh,
yes. I know you asked if the audience had any questions for the last presenter, but we should probably ask for general public comment on the topic as well.
Oh, okay. Any general public comment on this agenda item, either from online or in person? All right, seeing none, can move along. Consider adopting resolution number 2025-07, a resolution establishing fees for services.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Do we have a report on this?
Well, as part of the budget process, there was discussion about, you know, what can we do when we can only cut expenses so much since we've been in that practice for about two couple of years. And so we talked about ways we could increase revenue. We brought a number of ideas up and said that staff would be conducting a fee study internally. And so we've identified some ways in our fee schedule. I know it's a bit small on the screen, displayed a lot bigger on my monitor. But in any event, you know, just to hit a few, we've added a cruise ship fee, $100 per staff hour. That could generate $3,000 to $4,000 per ship. So a significant opportunity there. The Redwood Marine Terminal Storage, that could be $1,000 a month, or excuse me, in a year, it could be $10,000 in a year. It really depends on the occupancy. If we start looking at Woodley Island Marina, this is where we can start picking up some stuff. We've added a trash surcharge fee of $5 per slip per month. You know, if we think of 200 slips, we have a 237 slip marina. If 200 slips, we're paying that fee. You know, that's $1,000 a month. That's $12,000 a year. Our trash is something you've heard me talk on many times. We're paying at a minimum $3,600 a month to get rid of trash. We were paying well above $5,000, but we've just done a much better job with trash management and locking areas and not allowing outside trash to come into the marina. You know, but that's significant. Our liveaboards, we have some of the lowest fees on earth to live here. And currently our liveaboard is up to two people, $120 per month. We limit that to 24. We'd like to consider an expansion of that, and we're going to further define that in ordinance number 9 when we bring ordinance number 9 to you. But for all new, you know, the existing tenants, it'll be $120 a month. And for new tenants, $240 a month. And then each additional person would be additional $120 a month. You know, that's a fee for services amount. But, you know, if we were in a position to add a number of slips, you know, that could generate easily $28,000 plus a year. So these are things that, you know, you look at the fee times the number of slips times 12, you know, there's opportunity there.
And this is 12 months a year living.
Liveaboard would be, they'd be here, you know, on a term. That's correct. That's not transient.
Yeah.
Same thing with parking. You know, we really kind of had a fallacy in our trailer storage or automobile parking, just the way it was calculated.
And you cannot rent a trailer space or a boat space or an RV space anywhere even close to what, you know, what we were charging. So, you know, we're suggesting a pretty large change there from $200 per space period to $450. And we're still the best value, no doubt about it. Fish sales permits, currently it's $100 annually. We're suggesting that go to $300 per year. Again, we pale in comparison. We provide a lot. You know, keep in mind, you know, people have water here. They have access to, we put marketing materials out. We dedicate parking stalls for fish sales. We'll be enhancing our fish sales board. So there is a value that's received, you know, in turn for paying these sorts of things. We've left slip rents alone. They have CPI attached to them. We do know there is opportunity there, but we want to examine that at a future date. We're not looking to, you know, up every single fee in every single category. But there's a few other little things here, and I think the ones I want to really hit on is our sundries. We have people coming from all around the county to do their laundry here on Humboldt Bay because we're so cheap. So we, you know, you can just look at the comparison from one side to the other, but we're making a significant change there, and in essence, doubling fees in a lot of cases. We still will be, as of this survey, probably the lowest cost laundry in the region. So. Staff recommends approval, this is a resolution, so we'll need it spoken as such, and then we'll take a roll call vote. But staff recommends the board consider adoption of the resolution, amending the fees, and allowing us to go to work.
Could go into effect on.
Yeah, great. That's good. Thanks for doing the homework. And also, I just want to note how many things where there is no change. You know, as well. So I'm curious. I just have one question about the fish sales permit. Is it just for the docks here in the marina?
That is correct.
Or is it portable just across the bay for the Saturday?
No, that's just for jurisdictional authority. That's okay. Just here at Wood Island Marina.
All right. Thank you.
And so that fish sale fee, that's an annual fee?
Yeah.
That's,
if you have a vessel and you want to sell fish dockside, you would get a permit from the Harbor District office. Currently it's $100, and we're recommending that it go up to $300. Other marinas, one of the comparables, is $50 per month. So that's mm-hmm. $600.
And it's multiple species.
Mm-hmm. It's their catch. Yeah, what they're permitted to catch.
On the other terminals that are marinas, if it's $50 a month, is that like $50 per only when you're selling fish or $50.
I don't think we got into that deep of analysis on that. But most people that are buying them are year-round fishermen.
Yeah.
There are those that only fish one species. And keep in mind, one marina may have a different program than another marina. We did take a regional footprint, and then I took that a little bit further and went quite a bit farther north, quite a bit farther south, just because I have, you know, ports and harbor masters that I talk to periodically through our different affiliations. Generally, most people, if they're able to pay it monthly, they have a much elevated fee. If it's annually, it's usually a lower discounted fee. And I know we are the lowest right now and will remain the lowest at that fee based on the survey data that we have.
I mean, as an annual fee, it doesn't seem like much. It seems like a big increase, like a 3x increase. But maybe I defer to our local fishermen about that fee. That's the only one that...
The opportunities to sell dockside for most fishermen are albacore and crab. There's a few folks that do rockfish. There's very few people that have rockfish permits that allow them to do that. And the open access on those fish is very low. And the way I see it, if a person dedicates a certain amount of his time to dock sales and does crab and albacore, at the most you're probably going to participate 3 to 4 months of the year. So if it was a bi-month thing, that'd be $150 as opposed to $300. You said that some of the ports were charging $50 a month.
Yeah, we don't know what their minimum is, however.
I would assume that it's probably month to month, though, for places that a lot of people will go into a place like Half Moon Bay from Eureka, for example, and sell tuna. So they have to get a permit for short amount of time. So
should we change that to $100 a month and then just let them figure out if they want to do three?
I'm sure he'd like to change anything that's harder on the fisherman. I'm sure we'll
get second on that, right?
Maybe just
I don't want to bite on that, but I will say
no, I want to be fair, because that's something that, you know, it's great mm-hmm. to see growing, you know, and then the fish market, and you know, and I know we do a lot, and it'd be great. I have people always asking me, like, oh, how do I find out if anyone's selling fish at the marina? And as I tell them, if the office is open, call the office. If it's not, I don't know if we have someplace we can post it, but I just want to, I'm bringing up the topic. I don't have a particular suggestion here or how many active vessels
probably
do we 20. Have? About 20. Yeah. So,
if you think about it, by a tuna, they're selling between $4 and $5 a pound, and a tuna fish run average, how many pounds?
Probably from 8 to 25 pounds.
So,
it's a few fish.
The fishermen probably, if there was more advertising and whatnot that could come out of this, would appreciate that. There really isn't a lot of information unless you happen to come cruise the marina parking lot and see the sign and let you know that there's some fish for sale here. So,
how would you suggest we do that?
I'm sure that there's some sort of a Facebook or maybe something with the
billboard.
The Harbor District
lit up billboard, you know, like the one they have at Bear River Casino.
The Harbor District's
so website. You can see, we can put it here and you can see it from all over town.
Harbor District's website might work too.
So to bring this
sorry, yeah.
to bring this topic back to maybe a more pertinent discussion. I think, you know, we're happy to talk about the fee. That's not a problem. I think we have to take a step back also and realize the service that's provided for the fee. And, you know, one of the big considerations is replacing or redesigning and repairing the fish sale sign when you come in the arena and make it, or into the marina, and making that quite a bit more prominent, mm-hmm. Make it a little user-friendly. And understanding that, you know, maybe it sounds simple, but it costs money to put out all these signs, to remanufacture them when they get knocked over and they get dented, and to have a harbor maintenance worker, you know, going in and servicing the trash two or three times a day when they're being utilized. So, I may have advocated for the increase in the fee. It's not to oppose fisheries in any way, shape, or form. I think what we're trying to do is collect a fee that allows us to do more, not less. That's the intent behind it.
Is there anything in the works about disposing of
no
fish carcasses? The two go together: off boat sales and fish carcasses. They're going to happen.
And they go in the trash.
They can't go in the trash.
How are fish carcasses? This is getting off the topic of the.
It's not off topic because it's an expense that has to be borne by somebody at some point, because this stuff's got to go to a landfill that's approved or something. And if you're going to have people processing fish at the marina,
are they having to take it someplace else then?
There's no answer right now.
So, the district doesn't have any ability to provide disposal of fish carcasses right now. Just to be crystal clear,
fish cutting station with a grinder. I mean, that's a great idea. It works great.
I was just going to suggest they bring it down the Shelter Cove.
We do it out here on the tip of the island.
Send it out.
Sounds like you're taking a field trip.
Garden fertilizer. Sell as a garden fertilizer.
Send it out the outfall pipe.
Take it to Portilla?
Okay, well, I'm going to... I know I started this conversation. But well, then we need to take it out
road somewhere?
to the public. But
I think your point is good. I think Aaron's point is good, but I don't know, you know, what we could do to advertise for it. Facebook,
our website.
Our website would be nice. I don't know how.
I forget if the fishermen told us when they were selling fish.
Yeah, I mean that.
Yeah, that it takes some.
It takes some.
If you charge $300 or $100 a month, they might tell you. But I would say somebody on the Fisherman's Marketing Association probably.
I mean, it does kind of seem more like on that, like they could have a Fishing Marketing Association Facebook page where everybody put so those one place. Because I know some of the boats have their own Facebook pages where you can see if they're selling. But there's no place, or parking a truck on.
Generally, he's good at it.
101, but there's no place to really go to see everything right now.
That call in for fish, and then the boats come in, we give that list to fishermen so then they can call people. That's the service we provide.
I call and ask.
Yeah, a lot of people call and ask, and we always welcome those.
Yeah, that's always been helpful.
So I think you have an option to, you know, adopt this with an amended fee on that, if that's what you see fit. That's certainly an option. And it, you know, just one closing point on that. I do want to remind everyone that the Harbor District committed $5,000 to the Humble Fishermen's Marketing Association to support the offloading and sales over on the city side.
Mm.
So we are definitely using these funds to support fisheries. This is not a money grab for the benefit of the district or staff or automobiles or, you know, fancy pens. This is, again, this would allow us to do more. You're talking about advertising, not less. This is just simply to enhance services. So I'm happy with whatever we adopt, but I want to make sure we understand the intent of this is to enhance the program, not to grab an additional fee.
Yeah, I realize that. And it doesn't seem, I mean, in my completely uninformed opinion, that that's an unreasonable fee, but a 300% increase is a lot. So, but why don't we go out to the public, either online or in person, if anyone has an opinion.
It hasn't been raised in 8 years.
It just actually got created recently, too. We didn't charge for a long time.
Oh, we charge for the permit?
It was effective in 2015, and it was reviewed in 2020. It was reviewed in 22. So this, the best of that I'm able to provide record on is this was the first increase in a decade.
Since 2015.
That's just the record that we have on a half.
I'm good with my second.
And again, if the board wants to change that fee, I would just make the request that that be part of the resolution or the recommendation for the resolution.
We can see how it goes and change one line item at a later date if we wanted to. Right.
Staff would bring that back to the board. Yeah. If it was. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, are we getting any hands we do have a hand. Thank you.
So my name is Robin Gray Stewart, and I'm just speaking for myself tonight. As some of you know, I used to live on Woodley Island. And I didn't see a lot of tenants here tonight. Sometimes this place is full. So anyway, I just thought I should give you a personal perspective that when I was living here, I really appreciated that the fees were very reasonable, and I really like that. But like you said, things haven't been raised in a while, so I don't know where that stands with all the other marinas, but I really appreciated it being that way here. I lived here in the 80s and the 90s. And I would say this, though. I would really like to, and I would have liked back then to have seen the laundry rates go up. Because like you said, people were coming from all over the Eureka to their laundry. And at that time, I had a baby and then a toddler living on board with me. And it was hard to get into the laundry to do my laundry because there were so many people here. So I'm saying, great idea, raise the laundry. One place to make money. And I appreciate all that you guys do, but just thought you might like a little personal perspective on that.
Thank you. All right, well, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All right, then this is a resolution. We need a roll call.
Take a roll call vote. The resolution will be read, or is it made? It's fine.
Are you calling for the roll call?
I am calling for
the roll call. I was checking with council on procedure. Okay. So, Commissioner Norton?
Aye.
Yeah, Commissioner Dale?
Aye.
Commissioner Benson?
Aye.
Commissioner Newman?
Yes.
And President Coleman?
Yes. I would like to see us continue to explore ways, and I don't know what they are, that we could work with the Marketing Association to
absolutely
make it
easier for the public to figure out, because you know it's so hard for them to pick up a phone and dial a number.
Maybe what we'll do is bring our enhancements back so people can get a testimony of what is what we're doing. Maybe that would be helpful. And then we could, from that, we could maybe stir a discussion on other things we could do. Would that be helpful for the board?
Sure.
I think the Eureka Fish Market has been good in raising awareness as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very well attended.
We know that there's something on the sign saying that there's fish available in such and such a dock. That information can be put on the website pretty easily, I would think.
But it seems like there's a risk to that too. If it's on the sign and it's put on the website and then they sell out, are they going to come tell you to take it off the sign, or people are going to see the website? And
a lot of us keep eyes on who's selling, and we pass out those phone numbers. Really do try to help provide that information to anybody.
And the truth of the matter is, most people that are engaged in doing a lot of off-the-boat sales, they're pretty active in Facebook and whatnot, and they keep the word out.
Yeah, they really are exceptional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we have our consistency. So, you know, oysters every Thursday through Sunday, we always offer that. And we'll pay it when we pay
system. All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of the agenda. I will not be here in September. So have fun. I think I'll leave it in Craig's capable hands. And so then we're adjourned.